of Mexico in Houston, Miller Outdoor Theater presents Cinco de Mayo at Miller with Plin, Huicani, and Villalobos Brothers. Listen to traditional instruments and the beautiful sounds of El Arpa Jarocha, or the folk harp, as Tlen Huicani takes the audience on a mesmerizing journey through Mexico's music, time, and place. Acclaimed as one of today's leading contemporary Mexican ensembles, the Villalobos Brothers deliver an intoxicating brew of brilliance, cadence, and virtuosity that awaken the senses of the listener. For more information, visit MillerOutdoorTheater.com or call 832-487-7102. KPFT Houston.
That Easy Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Wednesday at 8 p.m. It is time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubichek, and along with our band of happy hosts, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton, engineer and media maven Nicole Rocherlin, syndicator Alondra Mejia, and intern Lisa Moore, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through enchanted worlds and through windows of their souls with personal stories that stretch the boundaries of the human heart. Want to apologize a little bit for tonight because I've got a really bad voice. So I'll be doing a Godfather imitation all night long. Besides, they just had their 45th anniversary, right? You have to excuse me. I spoil my kids. You remember the line. What fuels our labor of love is our collective role as posse, always on the lookout for storytellers who may try to escape from our eyes and ears. But when we find them, and we do, those who paint verbal pictures with words and gestures to create an excursion to a place we call magic, we ambush them, and we get them in the studio. And we got one here tonight. Attorney Jackie Ford is a partner in the Voorhees Houston office, where she focuses primarily on labor and employment law. She's also founder and former chair of the firm's Women's Initiative. She's conducted internal investigations for Fortune 500 companies, large universities, and many more, and provides counsel on crisis management and related communication issues. Jackie's a frequent speaker invited to address a range of employment law topics, from sexual harassment to workplace privacy to issues in the LGBT community. She also writes on social and legal topics that are relevant to employers in any industry, including her recent publication in the National Law Journal about lessons employers can learn from Hillary Clinton's email controversy. She received her AB from Oberlin College and her JD magna cum laude from Case Western Reserve University. She's caring and compassionate, and Jackie plays an important role in many organizations like Planned Parenthood, Friends of the Homeless, and Houston Grand Opera, just to name a few. She is a member of the American, Texas, Ohio, and Houston Bar Associations, and I became a member of her fan club because I've heard deliver stories with the skill and tenderness most can only imagine. Jackie, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. That's a very kind introduction.
Well, it's truthful, very, very truthful. I'm so glad you're here. I know that you were recently interviewed on 88.7 about the way employers should respond to sexual harassment, and I know it's hard to give a quick synopsis of what you revealed, but I think we want to know, give us a quick summary. Can you do that?
Sure. Well, I think one of the reasons they wanted to talk to me about it now was because of all the recent publicity around the Bill O'Reilly scandal that seems to still be playing out. Yeah. And I think some of the most basic lessons to learn are, don't do this. That would be the first one.
Right.
Beyond that, when companies get reports of that or rumors of that, they need to investigate them because they might be true and also because they might be false. And you owe it to everyone to look into those and take whatever steps you need to shut that down.
And we're going to be talking about your investigative powers, because in many ways it's reconstructing a story, which I'm fascinated by, and I know our listeners are too, and we're going to be getting to that in just a moment. But I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, but I got a kick out of knowing that your mother would be horrified knowing that you use the word sexual in the title, right?
Well,
let alone speaking about it on the radio. So I'm curious, what word would she have preferred in place of sexual?
Well,
erotic, fleshy, carnal? Which one comes to mind, Jackie? What would your mother want you to use?
Well, please, Hank, we're talking about my mother. You know, my mother had not worked outside of her home since 1941. And when she was in her 80s, I tried to explain to her, oh, I'm teaching a class on sexual harassment. And she was horrified that I was doing anything that had the word sexual in the title. So I tried to explain to her what sexual harassment meant. She'd never heard the term. Mm-hmm. And she finally got it. And she sort of buttoned up her cardigan sweater and said, sexual harassment? You're teaching a class? Well, I hope you're against it.
So. Right. So it was hard for her to mention that word. I get a kick out of that. I love that. When a company hires you to investigate, they are essentially asking you to construct a story. Talk to us about this a little bit.
Well, if a company wants you to investigate, say, a sexual harassment allegation, your job as a lawyer and investigator is to find out the facts and then shape those facts into a narrative that the company decision makers can understand, both as to understand what happened and to create a path going forward to create the kind of workplace you want to have.
And I find that fascinating, because just like a story, what you investigate and what you construct has to have a conflict. It has to have a sense of chronology. The details have to make sense. There can't be any gap. There can't be any kind of misunderstanding. Transitions have to make sense, segues, just like a story.
Essentially, that's true. And often, though, you do find there are gaps or there are conflicts. One person says the light was red. The other one says it was green. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to give your best judgment to that so that you can figure out a path to go forward.
How do you judge which is correct?
So there are lots
sort of instinctive.
Some of it is instinct. Some of it is whether it's plausible on its face. Is it something where normally a record would have been created, yet there is no record? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of extenuating and related circumstances can help you get to the truth.
When we met at the Moth a few months ago during intermission, I jammed my card in your face telling you that I wanted you to tell the story that you had just delivered, eventually on this program. It was a story about a journey. That was the theme that night, and it was about your father, and it really touched me and everyone in sight. And how did you feel when I came up to you? Other than the fact that who was this wild man throwing a card in my face?
Well, there was that.
Was that.
But then it was flattering, and it was also exciting to me because I had, you know, I had only recently discovered about the Moth itself in Houston, and I wasn't even familiar yet with the program. So to hear that you had a whole program on storytelling was terrific.
Yeah. Did you think your story was that powerful that night?
I heard a reaction in the audience at a certain point in the story, so I knew that a connection had been made, which was great.
And for whatever it's worth, and every host here could reinforce this, Nicole could reinforce it, we don't ask everybody at the Moth to be on the show, okay? We don't ask everybody to be on the show at all, but your story made an indelible impression on me. It really did, Jackie. You know, what prompted you to get up there and tell a story in front of hundreds of people? I don't know if that was your first time.
That's the first time I ever told a story at the Moth.
Yeah. What prompted you to say, you know what, I'm going to put my name in the hat and give it a shot?
I had been to the Moth twice before and seen other people do it. Mm-hmm. And I love that sense of connection among people in the audience, just regular people talking about their lives.
Right.
I do a lot of public speaking in my work and otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I knew I could handle being on a stage. But normally when I'm on a stage, I'm talking about the law. I'm talking about other people's facts and concepts. That was a new step for me to tell a story really about myself.
Well, the theme was journey, and I loved this story, and I think we all will. Tell it to us.
Thank you. In the winter of 1978, in January, I was 16 years old, and I went on a journey. I went from my hometown of Springfield, Virginia, up to Exeter, New Hampshire, and an extraordinary place called Phillips Exeter Academy. That Thursday morning in January, a family friend of ours, Stephanie, came to the house to drive me all that long way up to Exeter. And Stephanie was the one doing the drive because my father was ill and my mother needed to stay home and take care of my dad. So Stephanie had volunteered to drive me. And so we left before dawn, went on this long, long trip up the I-95 corridor. And I was excited the whole way. because it was an extraordinary opportunity for someone like me to go from a just regular middle class concrete kind of suburb outside of D.C. to this extraordinary school that was and is one of the top high schools in the country and perhaps even the world. And so as we did this trip about halfway north up I-95, it began to snow. And I thought that was extraordinary and beautiful, too. And it was one of those heavier snows where the snow really sticks to the fir trees. And we went through iconic New England town after iconic New England town. And the snow got a little heavier. And I thought it just got prettier and prettier. Of course, Stephanie was a little more concerned. She was sort of white-knuckled on the steering wheel of her Dodge Dart as she plowed through this snow. But eventually, after dark, we did get to Exeter. Snow was still continuing. There's probably about a foot of it on the ground. And I woke up in the morning and this bright blue sky and this bright sunshine. And during the night, that last bit of snow had had some ice mixed into it. And so it just glittered in that sunshine like 1,000 crushed diamonds had been spread into that top layer of snow. And I just thought it was one of the most beautiful things I had ever seen, one of the most beautiful places I had ever been. And I thought, I have come home. This is home. This is the place that I am meant to be. And Stephanie got me into my dorm and kissed me on the forehead and drove away. And I threw myself into that school. It's a long story why I was starting mid-year instead of the fall, but I was so excited to be there. And within a couple of days, it was pretty obvious that I might just be in over my head. You know, the other kids I was at school with were very smart and very knowledgeable, and many of them were way better prepared than I was for this extreme academic burden, and I just felt like I was starting to drown, and I was not doing very well in my classes. And then one day, about 2 weeks in, I got a little English paper back that we had written in class the day before, and I got an A-. And I thought, wow, maybe I'm not an imposter. Maybe I can actually do this. And I felt so good, and I came out of the classroom, and I had a little kick in my step. And Miss Keel was waiting for me outside the classroom. She was a teacher who lived in the dorm with us at boarding school. The faculty live in the dorms. And she said, you need to come back to the apartment with me. Your brother needs to talk to you. And I'm the youngest of five children, and this was my oldest brother who was calling. So I got back to the apartment, and he called, and he said, Daddy's really sick. You need to come home. There's a plane ticket waiting for you at the airport. Miss Keel is going to drive you. You need to pack your bag right away and get home. And that's all he wanted to say about it. Now, I had seen enough melodramatic black and white movies on our little TV at home to know that when someone is called home because of a sick relative, it probably means that that relative is dying. And I knew my dad had cancer, but I certainly didn't think that things could escalate so quickly. But Miss Keel got me to the airport. I got on the plane, and while I sat on the plane, I remembered another thing about those black and white melodramatic movies, and that is that they never want to let the kid go to the hospital. You know, the kid's not supposed to go. So I thought, I have to be prepared for that. So I wrote a little speech, and I memorized it about why I should be allowed to go to the hospital to see my dad. So I got home to the house late that afternoon, and everyone was just sort of standing around drinking coffee, and there didn't seem to be a sense of urgency, so I finally said, when can I go see Daddy? And that's when they told me that my father had died the night before. And they hadn't wanted to tell me over the phone, hundreds of miles away, among strangers, in all that snow. And a very deep grief took its hold, and it kept its hooks in me for quite a long time. But then a second layer of grief kicked in not too long after, which was, in addition to losing my dad, I was going to have to give up Exeter because someone needed to stay home and kind of keep an eye on my mother for a variety of reasons. And I was really the only one who could do that. And on top of that, I was having my own struggles and really shouldn't be, you know, hundreds of miles away at that time. So I had to withdraw from Exeter. And the next week, I went back to school at the same high school I had left with a big chip on my shoulder just a few weeks earlier. So that was a very tough time. And in the meantime, I tried to adjust to that sense of loss at both ends. And one morning in March, I woke up and I heard this scraping noise outside. And I looked out and we'd had a big snowstorm, very unusual. And I realized the scraping sound was my mother shoveling the snow I thought, well, I'm supposed to help my mother, so I got out of bed, I put my coat on, I grab another shovel, I go outside, and she is attacking this snow. She is wailing on that snow. And I said, Mother, good Lord, what are you doing? And she said, this isn't right. I said, well, I know. We don't usually get snow like this in March. She said, no, I'm not talking about the snow. It's not right. It's not right that your father is not here to do this. And it's not right that you are here. Your dad was so proud of you and so happy for you, so excited for you to be able to go away to school like that. That's where you need to be. You need to go back. And at that point, I couldn't imagine that. But I took several days and I thought about it, and we eventually called the school and they said, well, you'd have to reapply. So I reapplied and miraculously I got in again. And so that August, it wasn't Stephanie, but my mother driving the car up the I-95 corridor. And this time it wasn't snow. It was this beautiful green in all these towns, just verdant and fresh and beautiful. And we got to Exeter and she moved me into the dorm and kissed me on the forehead and drove away. And that year that I spent there was something that has stayed with me the rest of my life and all for the good. And we had a lot of snow that year. We had a second round of blizzards in 1979 to match the ones in 78. But to this day, Exeter is the place that feels most like the place I am meant to be. It feels most like home. And to this day, some of my best friends and the best things in my life are things that I trace back to Exeter. And what I think I learned from that journey, first with Stephanie and then with my mother, is that each of us is looking in our own way for that place that is that best place, that place that we are really meant to be. And at the end of the day, we're all just driving each other home.
I love that story, and what I love about that story really is that the icon, the core, is Exeter, mm-hmm. and there are so many emotional shifts around it, and everything comes back to it, mm-hmm. and that kind of central focus, I think, is extremely rare. I hope you didn't mind that I asked you to tell the story again.
Oh, not at all.
Okay. How do you feel as it unfolds again? Because you tell the story as if it's the first time every time, which is good, right?
I think, it's been all these years, right, since 1978, and there's still a little emotional hook for me there about midway through. And, I certainly don't second guess any of the decisions that any of the adults made at that time. I don't know what I would do if it were my own daughter, in that sort of situation. But it's a little bit cathartic, but I think there are some things in it that, while it's my unique story, mm-hmm. it does, connect to other people's experience in many other ways.
Yeah, just beautiful. You are listening to guest storyteller Jackie Ford on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.9 in Huntsville. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek. I've got a bad voice. You are not missing a dial. You're not having a faulty radio. So stay tuned. Besides, I'm not the teller tonight. You're listening to wonderful Jackie Ford. And you got Nicole Rochelin in at the control. So if all else fails, she'll tell you a story too. Isn't that right, Nicole?
Sure, I will.
Yeah, right. Houston's become nothing less than one of the country's storytelling hubs because of a lot of reasons. And you are about to tell us what some of them are.
I am indeed. I'm still trying to get myself together. That story was awesome. And speaking of that, we are receiving texts that story was amazing. So thank you to all of our Facebook Live listeners and the people that are calling and texting in, letting us know that was awesome.
Thank you so much.
But let me tell you a little bit more, guys, that there are too many to list, but our sponsors, the Houston Storyteller Guild, is a great place to start. Their swaps meet the fourth Tuesday of every month in the library at Temple Emmanuel, located 1500 Sunset. Also, if you go to their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for all the fun happenings and to listen to all of our past So What's Your Story programs. And every show since 2008 are on there, so make sure you check it out. by going to the menu and clicking on the radio program and enjoy. Also, if you go to our So What's Your Story Facebook page and tell us your thoughts and program ideas and share our page with your friends, we'd love to hear your feedback, and we would even love it even more if you would like us before you leave. We always have incredible clips of our tellers on YouTube, and our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, is more fun than the law allows.
Thank you, Nicole. Now, here's something very exciting. Our program and the Guild will be sponsoring award-winning Texas teller Larry Thompson at Hickory Hollow at Heights and Washington. Many of you know that Houston institution. On Saturday, June 3rd from 11 to 12:30, there is nothing to pay for but your lunch. Larry's tales about cowboys, family, wild times, and as he would say, his OHL moments, which are great, are not to be missed. Don't take my word for it. You can find him on YouTube as well as on the show on August 27th, 2015, when he was my guest. And he's going to be right here in the studio on Wednesday, May 31st. And get ready to be wowed. He is unbelievable. And it all happens in one place, of course, right here. It's a What's Your Story? Only on 90.1 KPFT, Houston. You know, George Bernard Shaw once wrote, if you cannot get rid of family skeletons, you may as well make a dance. I'm not sure if this applies directly to you, Jackie, but you do have some intriguing yarns about your family. Your next story is about a visit to your mother's grave, as a case in point, right?
I believe it is. Thank you. So, in the spring of 2014, I was in Washington, D.C., and had the opportunity to visit my parents and my grandparents that morning. And when I say visit them, I mean visit their gravesites. My mother and my father and my father's mother and father are all buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And the reason all four of them were there is because my father and my grandfather qualified to be buried there because of their service to this country. My grandfather was a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy in the Second World War. My father was a career Air Force officer, or colonel in the Air Force, who served both in World War II and the Vietnam War. And so they both qualified to be there. Now, if there's one thing Arlington Cemetery has, it is a lot of rules. And one of the rules is that if you qualify to be buried there, your spouse can be buried there as well. But it is one grave and one headstone to a couple. So, for example, my mother and father are buried in a single grave. And on the headstone, my father's information is on the front, and my mother's information is on the back. And my parents and my grandparents were all extremely rule-driven people. They liked rules, they liked symmetry, they liked sameness, they liked predictability, they liked structure, they liked hierarchy. So a military cemetery, and particularly one with all the precision and grandeur and beauty of Arlington, I always thought it was sort of the perfect place for the four of them to be buried in this beautiful spot. So my mother had died the year before. She was the last of the four of them to pass away by quite a margin. And this was the first time I was back there to see the headstone after my mother's information had been added on the back. So I contacted Arlington ahead of time and got a special family pass that allowed me to have a car drive me into the facility. Arlington is several hundred acres. It's a very large place. And normally you would have to be dropped at the visitor center. But this way I could have the taxi bring me in, drive me to the little lane near where my parents are buried, and then drive me to the other side of the facility where my grandparents are. And so the taxi driver picked me up, and I explained to him what I was doing. And of course he was very solicitous, very kind, and said he'd be happy to wait for me once we got inside. So we drive inside over to where my parents are buried, which is a lovely spot with a view of the Pentagon. My dad had been stationed at the Pentagon at one point, so it was very nice to see that. And it was a lovely morning with a breeze, and I went over and I looked at my dad's headstone, as I had several times before. And then I went around the back to look at my mother's information. And the way these are formatted, on the front, the military service member has a little symbol for their religion, and then it has their name, date of birth, date of death, and dates of service and active duty war specifications. And for the spouse, it just says his wife, and then has her first name or first and middle name, and her date of birth and her date of death. That's it. Because the only reason she's there is because she's his wife. Okay, I knew that. I was ready for that. My mother's name was Mary Ford, or Mary Elizabeth Ford. Her maiden name was Quirk, which starts with a Q. Somehow, this got mangled so that on her headstone, it says, his wife, Mary Q. You know, like Ellie Mae, you know, Mary Q. That was most certainly not my mother's name. And I was horrified. I thought, how is this possible? I was really irritated. I thought I was going to have this very, you know, sweet and contemplative moment. And instead, I'm looking at a typo. So I get my phone out and I take a picture of both sides of the headstone. And I am irritated. I get back in the cab and I'm messing with this map of Arlington to figure out where my grandparents' grave is. And I'm clearly upset. And the cab driver says, oh, ma'am, I'm so sorry. This must be a time of such grief. I said, grief? I'm just irritated. My mother's type, you know, there's a typo on my mother's headstone. And he says, well, I don't see how that could happen. How can someone make a mistake like that? And while he's talking, I thought, who was the person who filled out the paperwork at the internment center? Actually, I think that was me. Huh, okay. Well, okay, now I feel even worse. So we head over to where my grandparents are buried on the other side of the facility, and I was trying to remember when was the last time I was there, and I actually couldn't think of a time that I had actually visited their grave. I'd been to my parents, my father, several times, but for some reason I hadn't visited my parents, my grandparents, and they had died in the early 1970s. So we finally find the spot, and it's a long kind of walk down the lane, and my grandparents are under this lovely tree. It's a really nice little setting. And on the front, my grandfather's information is correct. Ralph Randall Ford. Good. I go around to look at my grandmother's information on the back. My grandmother's name is listed as Athel Randall Ford. Randall is my grandfather's middle name. It is not part of my grandmother's name. My grandmother had three middle names, and that isn't one of them. My grandmother's headstone is wrong. And it's been wrong since 1973. Could it be that no one in our family has been here since 1973 to see that this headstone is wrong? What is wrong with us? So I get out the phone again and I take more pictures and I'm thinking, you know, what am I going to say to my brothers and sisters? And then I notice something else that's a little odd. At the base of the headstone, there are several stones that are clearly not there by accident. And there are several more along the top of the headstone itself. Now, in the Jewish tradition, one leaves stones at the gravesite as a sign of respect. My grandparents were not Jewish. If anything, to be perfectly candid, they were sort of anti-Semitic. And so I'm looking around, and I look, well, maybe some kind person has come by and left stones out of respect at all the graves. Nope, just theirs. And there aren't stones on any grave that I can see for half a mile. And that is when the thought came into my head of what my friend Corinne refers to as a God wink. That in this place about uniformity and sameness, where every headstone is the same, they're all the exact same distance from each other, they're made of the same materials, they follow the same format, even within that, each one has its own story. Sometimes an ironic story, sometimes an incorrect story, but each one has its own story. And that even in this place of overwhelming loss and grief and sadness, even in that place, God winks.
I love that. Now, what are you going to do about this? Is there anything you can do to correct these headstones?
You know what? I haven't. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mention in the story, but when my father's headstone was put in, it had an error. Really? They left out his Vietnam service off the headstone, and it was such an important part of his life that we petitioned back to the military and said, hey, could you fix that? And they did.
Yeah. You know, there's also something very ironic. The stones that you're making reference to is used because they never die. You know, flowers do. So your grandfather will be viewed as a Jew for eternity.
Well,
I just wanted you to know that.
And you know, there are some Jews who have married into our family, and I have two immediate family members who have converted to Judaism.
Yeah.
But I'm quite sure it was neither one of them.
I hope their headstones are normal and they're accurate.
And you know what?
Yeah,
and I left the stones exactly where I found them, of course.
You know what the lesson is, don't you?
Hmm.
Leave no stone unturned. You knew that was coming. You didn't know that was coming, did you?
I didn't see it. Sorry.
What would you like to tell your mother if she was here right now? Something that you would say on the air. What would you like to tell her?
Oh, something
this is
I
always,
can...
This is always a fun question. I ask every guest this when their parent is in the story, and you know their parent would have something interesting to say the least, right?
You know what? I am going to tell another story about my mother later on, and I have a lot of stories about her because she was a very unusual character. But she also, in all seriousness, was probably the bravest person I ever knew. That bravery wasn't always directed in the best possible ways. Sometimes it steered into sheer obstinance, but she really was the bravest person. And when I look at my two daughters, the things we always wanted for them were to be happy, healthy, and strong. And I think a lot of that strength comes from her and from their other grandmother. And I guess I would want her to know that yeah. strength is passed on to them and to so many of her children and grandchildren.
Yeah. Did your mother know that she would be in the same grave as her husband?
Yes.
Okay. And that didn't bother her?
No, it was a very common thing. We grew up surrounded by military people, and right. we knew people buried at Arlington.
Yeah.
And her in-laws were already buried that way
yeah.
long before my mother yeah. passed away.
Yeah. I mean, my wife is right there. Hi, honey. And we are in a king-size bed, and we feel crammed, right? Of course, we have our little chihuahua Simon between us, so maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. That's amazing. That is amazing. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are enjoying my guest storyteller, Jackie Ford, on So What's Your Story, 90.1 KPFT Houston, or you can catch us live online at www.kpft.org. You know, we've got four hosts on this program, each with a unique style and even a philosophy. And Warren Holloman, for example, likes to talk about the way stories connect us, bringing us closer together. And he is so very right. And Nicole, you had an experience recently that reinforced this notion. As a matter of fact, it's sort of giving you an opportunity to solidify this event that you're going to be hosting. Tell us about that a little bit, please.
Absolutely. Well, recently I had received a scholarship for the Women's of Excellence and Empowerment Conference here, and I met some wonderful, wonderful people. And during that time, as we were networking and talking about what we had to contribute to society, we were talking about, you know, what I did here at So What's Your Story. So as I was explaining about So What's Your Story and how we use stories to empower and connect, and it's the common people with the uncommon stories that help us be relatable to one another, it was very intriguing. I received great feedback, and it was in the African-American community who really was very happy about what we were doing here at So What's Your Story, because it also was giving them an outlet to know that they can also tell their stories, and their stories mm-hmm. are significant as well. So that led to this event on May 13th, which is Mother's Day weekend, that I was asked to be a special MC and red carpet host, well, actually purple carpet. It is for Invisible Signs. They're having an event called Rated X, and it's going to be at Center Stage Art Gallery. And again, I will be their featured host. And we also have some other African-American storytellers that are coming out to tell their stories about
Wonderful.
Mental health,
yeah.
which is a big problem in the African-American community. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity, and I'm grateful for all of the support and love that we receive.
Right. Thank you, Nicole. That's beautiful. You know, it's really all about recognizing the kind of connection that you're developing between the community and this show. Right. And I just love that. That is great.
Thank you. I think
it is now time for Tips for the Teller. Is that right?
Yes, that is right.
All right. All right. All right. Yeah, we have a little goofy tune that we're not playing because my voice is goofy enough. But, you know, Tips for the Teller is a short segment when we offer a quick tip to help you darn your yarn. Short stories work best and define less is more. The best way to keep them short is to think of an episode, a memorable speck in time that lasted a few seconds or maybe a moment. Don't tell the story about your wedding day, but rather the instant you realize your wedding cake had the names Scott and Diane, and yours and your bride-to-be are Tony and Trish. The moment you saw your father cry for the first time, when you knew you were in love, that first kiss, opening your gift, expecting those cool sneakers, and finding underwear instead. Episodes encourage depth, not breadth. And by constructing the details in your episode chronologically, you add clarity and guidance for your listeners. Now, learn it, don't memorize it, and have a ball. And by the way, here's another tip. Tune in next week when Mary Edgerton will host Rebecca Grant, another lawyer. No lawyer jokes here. We obviously love them, right? Okay. We love you guys. For another live telling tantrum on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT Pacifica Radio. Now for a story about your grandmother and mother's hearing loss. This is the story that you're making reference to, that you had another story about your mom. Right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And it's primarily about my mother, but my grandmother as well. My mother's ears were located squarely in the middle of her chest. At least that's the way it seemed to me as a very small child. And in order to communicate with my mother, I had to do a kind of oral calisthenics. I had to direct my voice toward her chest while also tipping my face up and my chin up so that she could hear me with her eyes, because she needed to combine sound with lip reading in order to understand anyone. My mother had been born with about a 75% hearing loss, and she didn't get her first hearing aid until she was in her mid-40s and had 5 children at home. And even then, the only reason she got one was twofold. One, transistors had evolved enough to make the hearing aid of some use to her. But second of all, my father was going to Vietnam and was going to be gone for about a year, and she had 5 children and needed to be able to drive them around, so she needed to get a driver's license. And in California at that time, to get a driver's license, you had to be able to hear well enough to hear a siren, hence the arrival of the hearing aid. And the hearing aid was in a box the size and shape of like a cigarette box, and it attached with a pin on the back that either clipped to her bra or could be put on a satin ribbon that hung around her neck. Now, my father's mother lived with us part of the year, and she also was essentially deaf. She had lost her hearing in her 20s as a result of a bout with scarlet fever. So my mother and my grandmother were the two women who were kind of in charge of me, and I grew up thinking any woman of a certain age who was in charge of me couldn't hear. My first day of kindergarten, I was quickly disabused of that notion when I said something under my breath and was quite shocked that the kindergarten teacher could hear me just fine. Thank you very much. But even as my mother got a hearing aid, all of the kids in the family knew perfectly well that if you didn't want mother to hear you, it was very easy to avoid having her hear whatever you were saying. All you had to do was turn your face away or just speak without moving your lips, which is why all 5 kids in my family, any one of us, could make a living as a ventriloquist, because we used to do that all the time. And if you didn't make eye contact in particular, mother would have no idea you were speaking. Now, this is a terrible, reprehensible thing to take advantage of someone's disability like that, but we did it every single day. And it was kind of like the kids against the grown-ups. And my mother in particular, especially in those years, was an extremely difficult person and extremely volatile. And so if you didn't engage her in conversation, she couldn't have anything to argue with you about. So that was part of the defense of it, too. But we did that all the time. And so not surprisingly, my mother felt very cut off. And she knew there were conversations going on around her all the time that she was not part of. And her mind, of course, would fill in the blanks as to what everyone else was talking about that she was not part of, because you had to make an affirmative effort to bring her into the conversation. And even when she got better hearing aids in later years that hooked over the ears rather than, you know, were suspended on the chest, she never got over her reliance on lip reading. So as I got older, I felt guilty about the way we had treated her when we were kids. And I thought, well, maybe I can atone for that. I can bring her into more of my own activities and do more with her and connect with her more. So on Mother's Day, the year that she was 63 years old, I took a big splurge and I bought tickets to take her to a play called Children of a Lesser God. If you're familiar at all with that play, it's about a deaf woman trying to navigate the hearing world versus the world that relies on sign and trying to decide which world she wants to live in. And it was playing at the National Theater in Washington. So this was an expensive ticket, but it was a Sunday matinee. I got us tickets for the middle of the orchestra section. And the reason I wanted to go to this play in particular was not just the subject matter, but because they had this special adaptive equipment that was brand new, and they had just invested in the theater to have this equipment available, that you could attach to hearing aids to enhance the sound of the stage. I explained this to Mother before we went to the show, but, you know, she was pretty dubious, but, you know, fine, she'd go along. So we go down to the theater, and I you know, have our tickets, and then I spend even more to get this equipment, and we sit in our seats, and she's rolling her eyes, and we put the stuff on, attach it to the hearing aids, and the lights go down, and the curtain goes up. And I look over, and out of the corner of my eye, I see my mother moving, and she's beginning to lean forward. And she leans further forward and further forward. And she's a sort of small person, small boned. And she leans further and further forward so that her body is making sort of a sideways V with her lap as the bottom part of that V. And as she leaned forward and she made this sideways V, it was sort of the shape of the lesser than sign in mathematics. And then her mouth came open and stayed that way with her chin up a little bit and her mouth open. And she stayed in that position, frozen, for the entire first act. With her mouth open and the tiny little features that she had, she looked like a little bird who had been fed in the nest and was just keeping her mouth open so she didn't miss the next morsel. And we got to the intermission, and the lights came up. And she turned to me, and her eyes were just very slightly wet. And she took the contraption off her ears and said, "That's the first time I have ever heard every word of a play." And it seemed obvious when I heard it, but I had never thought of it ever before. She'd never heard every word of a movie, every word of a play, ever in her life. And then out of the blue, she said to me, "You know, when your dad asked me to marry him, I told him no." I said, "You did?" And she said, "Yes, the first time." And I said, "Why?" She said, "We were parked in the car at the driveway of my dad's house, and your dad asked me to marry him, and I said no, and he seemed very shocked and upset and asked me why. And I said, 'Well, Jeff, I'm hard of hearing.' And he said, 'Well, Mary, did you think I hadn't noticed?'" And she said, "But obviously someone like that, someone like me, I can't get married. I can't be a wife. I can't have children." And he said, "Why not?" And talked her into it. And she went on, of course, to have 5 children and a very long life. She died at the age of 92. And so she said all of this to me with not a trace of sadness or any sense that she had been wronged in any way. It was just a fact. It just was, like the weather. It just was. And we ended the show and turned in the equipment, and we went home. And she lived another 35 years. And as far as I know, she never went to another play.
Wow. You're awfully reflective when you tell that story. What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about what it would have been like every day of your life to know. There's so much going on in the world that you don't know. And one thing I learned as I got older was, think about the things you learn because you overhear them, because someone says them quietly, because you hear them behind a closed door, things that people whisper. All of those things went right past her. So she sort of knew that there were gaps, and she didn't know what those gaps were. And I think it really took a toll over time.
Do you think her other senses were heightened because she couldn't hear?
She did seem to have certain other heightened senses. She would tell stories about waking up in the night and just knowing something was wrong with one of the kids when we were babies and going in, that sort of thing.
Yeah. The people that I've known that have been hearing impaired seem to have heightened, you know, one of my favorite plays is Butterflies Are Free. I don't know if you remember. Yeah, Leonard Gersh was a professor who wrote a great play many years ago, and it was on Broadway. Goldie Hawn and Edward Albert Jr. were the two characters. And you know, it was about a young man, 16 years old, Don Baker, who was not able to see from birth. He wasn't able to see a thing. So, of course, to him, everybody might as well have been blind because he was so used to it. And he played the guitar, and he couldn't make it in Scarsdale, so he moves to New York City. He gets himself a little loft in the Lower East Side near Washington Square Park, and he's getting ready for a gig that night. And his next-door neighbor, who's played by Goldie Hawn on Broadway, knocks on the door and says, "Hey, you're really good." And he says, come on in. And she doesn't know that he's blind. Her name is Jill Tanner. Doesn't know that he's blind because, after all, he's not doing anything to demonstrate any kind of visual impairment at all. He's been born blind. No sunglasses, no dog, no cane, no glare, no nothing. The only thing she notices is that the place is really neat. I didn't know guys are so tidy, is what she says. So they're talking. And he lights up, she lights up a cigarette, and she takes the ashtray off of the coffee table and is walking around the apartment, flicking ashes in it. Then a few moments later, Don Baker lights up a cigarette and is flicking it on the coffee table where the ashtray was supposed to be. And of course, she turns to him and asks, is there something you know that I don't know? Like, ashes are good for the table? Is that why you keep flicking them there? And he asks, did you move the ashtray? And she, of course, sarcastically replies, yeah, what are you, blind? And, you know, suddenly she takes a double take when he says, yes. She says, what do you mean, yes? Yes, you asked me if I'm blind, and I'm blind. Well, she's really uncomfortable, but after a while, she becomes a little bit more comfortable with the notion that she just insulted this guy. And she asks, is it true that blind people have a sixth sense? To which he says, well, if that were true, we'd still only have five now, wouldn't we? Right? That always made an impression on me. That's why I was asking about your mom, because these other senses just, they seem to be heightened. I'm reminded of a really, really quick story when my grandfather was dying. I'll never forget. It was in the hospital, and my grandmother was there, and she's apologizing to him. She's saying, I am so sorry for anything that I've ever said. I'm sorry for saying this and that. I'm sorry that I might have said that to you, and I'm sorry that, you know, after we got out of concentration camp and we found each other, I never told you how much I loved you and how much I missed you and how grateful I am. And I'm sorry that I picked on you for so many years. I'm sorry that I told you to lift your legs when you walk. I'm sorry because I know you had Parkinson's and I just picked on you all the time. And he turns to her and he says, don't worry about it. I never listened to you. Right? Yeah, which I think probably says it all. It says it all. Beautiful. Thank you so much. Who was the storyteller in your home growing up?
Well, I think all of us kids had a tendency to do that. It was a way to entertain each other, and it was yet another layer of this, you know, us against the grown-ups thing. And we would keep each other amused with that. But particularly my oldest brother, Alex, is a terrific storyteller.
Alex still around telling the stories?
Oh, he's around all right. And like everyone in my family, mm-hmm. he's a story in and of himself. He may be listening at this moment. You know I'm saying this yeah. with all the love in the world. Mm-hmm. I refer to him as beloved brother. He refers to me as beloved sister.
Right.
And
what
he's,
kind of stories did he tell?
What I think everyone in my family has a tendency to do is to take the everyday and turn it into a story. So if you're stuck at the airport, mm-hmm. you listen in on the conversations of the people around you and you turn mm-hmm. it into a narrative and you come home and tell that story. That's the kind of thing that we just sort of yeah. did as a survival technique and a way to, you know, keep each other entertained.
Yeah. Give us an example of that. You're sitting at the airport, you're waiting for a business trip, and you look to your left and there's a guy really frustrated. He's looking at his watch. He's sighing. Make up a story about that.
Well, I will actually tell you one that
okay.
happened to me recently, because I do
right.
a lot of business travel mm-hmm. and you do get stuck in airports.
Yeah.
I think you can pretty well date a person mm-hmm. As they're over or under 50 if they can remember a time when flying was pleasant. They are definitely over 50. Anyway, I mean, we grew up
yeah,
dressing
well,
for the plane and the
yeah,
whole deal.
Uh-huh, yeah,
but
yeah.
in any event, so mm-hmm. I was stuck in the airport once recently and mm-hmm. doing my usual, you know, eavesdropping on people. And I heard this woman on the phone. Now, not a lot of eavesdropping was required.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard her in the gate area, and then she ended up sitting behind me on the flight. And apparently she was breaking up with a guy named Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And she's
mm-hmm.
yelling at Bill, Bill, I have moved on. I have moved on. I've moved out. I moved out of the house. How further on could I get, Bill? She's just wailing and yelling at this guy.
Right,
yes.
Right,
and then
right,
it continues,
course.
You know, behind me mm-hmm. in the seat on the plane. And mm-hmm. I sort of made up a narrative for her and Bill and what might have caused the rift in this otherwise happy couple.
Very good. I love it. Yeah. There's prompts all over the place, though, aren't there?
Well,
every place you look.
And it's a way for me, mm-hmm. too. I think it's mm-hmm. a way to take the randomness of life and get a little control over it.
Right.
You take
right.
whatever elements are around you. You have a coffee cup. You have a microphone. You have some paper.
Right.
You turn that into a story. story of how that cup got here, right? Yeah, and so now that randomness of just the cup being there on the table in front of you, you own it now. You have some control over it, and you can turn it into a story.
How do you use this creative methodology, if you will, in court, or how do you use it in your practice?
Well, I think anyone who spends time in court or before federal agencies or making presentations to clients, particularly when you're talking about employment-related issues, which is the primary thing that I do, people relate to stories. So you can teach a principle of law by putting it into a story. Mm-hmm. You either take the fact pattern of an actual court case and use that as your story, or you make up what we would call a fact pattern or a case study, and you have them sit down and work it through. And you make up characters, and you base the case maybe loosely on a real case, and you have people work through that story and say, okay, I am this character. What would I do in this story if I heard these words or I saw these things happen? And so you walk people through it in a kind of active storytelling way that was more likely, I think, to stick with them than just reciting, you know, page after page of legal definitions.
Yeah. What would you like to do in the future in terms of your storytelling career? That may be a bad way of labeling it, but what would you like to do eventually?
Well, I do have this lawyer gig. It's my day job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like every lawyer, I think I have the great American novel in me. So I started writing a book some years ago and put it aside. So I'd like to go back to that. But I really enjoy just the give and take of lots of people telling stories. So this kind of programming, The Moth, others like that, I enjoy going. I enjoy hearing stories and that sense of connection to other people that comes with that.
Other than a connection, what do you get from listening to people's stories, other than just being nosy and wanting to get this access disclosure for no reason?
You know,
because you really allow authenticity to enter our social relationships in a way when you hear these stories.
I would agree with that.
They're wonderful. They're wonderful. And I know it sounds like a strange question, but sometimes I think about what I get out of it. And I really become a much better person. I become more sensitive. I become far more compassionate. I find myself listening to people in a way that I never thought possible. Really?
Well, I'll give you two examples. I heard a story at The Moth. I can't remember if it was this time or the time before. Very moving story about a gentleman telling it who he said he and his wife had taken their newborn baby to see their friend who was dying of AIDS. This was in the 80s in Montrose.
Right.
And it was an incredibly moving story, not just about the you know, human compassion of that particular couple, but of all of us. And it really elevated it. And I have thought about that story so many times since, and it gave me such a sense of shared humanity that there really is hope in the world for people doing right by each other.
It really validates our life in so many different ways. You know, as I tell students all the time, I tell them, you know, we're born with a blank page, and everything that happens to us is theoretically a page in that book. And that's what our lives are, just one long book. It's just a matter of, you know, right, that's a whole other story. But it's a matter of where we start the chapter and where we ended. Other than personal stories, traditional stories, you have any favorite stories, favorite authors?
Oh, gosh. I do have a lot of favorite authors, sort of the classic authors. You know, I love Jane Austen, the idea of taking this sort of intricate community and turning it into a story. And I think that's why we've seen so many of these modern day Jane Austen, you know, frameworks being told today. So I like the type of story where there's some intricacy to the interrelationships of the various characters coming in and out of the story and coincidences and things that you might not otherwise see.
You had mentioned earlier in the evening about movies and about the fact that you sometimes see a story in a movie, or you were talking about the inextricable relationship between those two. One of the things that I have found in recent years, and I'm sure you can relate to this one, is that you have to be at least 50 to know what a good movie looks like and sounds like, because there's actually dialogue and acting, right? And they were stories. They were stories. And now, I know that's a blatant statement and it's an exaggeration. There are some really good movies recently, too. But, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s even, stories and movies were the same. You couldn't see a movie without it possessing a story. Does that make sense?
I think it does, but I wouldn't sell contemporary movies totally short.
No,
a movie like Manchester by the Sea.
Oh, well, that is one of the examples of a magnificent movie, and that is a really good example. But, you know, there were a lot of movies like that years ago.
And I think one of the things that makes that mm-hmm. a great story, makes the character so believable, is that mm-hmm. they are not one-dimensional. There's not good guys and bad guys. Everyone has layers to them, and I think right. that's consistent with how real people really are.
Right. Very, very good. You have any shout-outs tonight? Anybody you want to talk to? Anybody that you want to yell at and say, you better be listening to me?
Well, I always yell at my daughters.
Good.
So
good
I would call
you.
Out.
I knew you were normal. You were so normal on so many different levels. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. my daughters are 26 and 21, mm-hmm. and one is kicking it in law school, and the other one is...
hey, great. Where's she going to law school?
She's at The Ohio State University.
And, you know, I went to Ohio State. I think I told you that. And
yes.
the brightest and the best of us tend to go there.
Of course.
It's a fact.
Everyone knows
it's
that.
It's an absolute fact.
Go yeah. Bucks.
A lot of people don't know that, but it's true that recent research demonstrates that those people who went to Ohio State are some of the most incredible people in the world.
Absolutely.
I just happen to have gone there, but it's really true. Isn't that right, Nicole?
You are absolutely right, Dr. Hank.
Yeah,
you're still getting a B in the course, Nicole. It doesn't make any difference how
a passionate
you
are. Okay, well, never mind. I retract the statement.
No, I read your paper the other day. It wasn't bad. Not bad.
Thank you.
It might have been better, but it was very, very good.
You had to say that on the radio.
No, it was very good.
Oh, okay.
I'm only Nicole. Teasing you. Only giving you a hard time. Just giving you a hard time.
Nicole, you just need to learn how to say go Bucks.
Yeah. Let
go
me tell
Bucks.
You something. Nicole and Lisa's right here, too. Lisa's just kind of filming us, right, Lisa? She doesn't want to talk. That's okay. She doesn't talk much. But, you know, Lisa is just doing a great job sitting here doing the YouTube and the Facebook Live. We have a team here that's really worth talking about for just a moment, something I don't usually do, but we have a minute or two. You know, Nicole, Lisa, and the entire team here on So What's Your Story is a very special collection of folks who are incredibly committed to an art form that's been around for centuries, for, you know, since 2000 BC, and they're really resurrecting it in a way that this city has never seen before, and I'm incredibly proud of that, really proud of that. Any thoughts about tonight? We're almost done. It wasn't bad, right?
Wasn't bad, and it was great to meet you all, and I'm so happy that you're doing this program and bring storytellers to an audience in Houston.
Yeah, well, we're so happy to have you here, Jackie, really. You know, it's the storyteller's unwavering commitment, I think, to communicate the story that makes the story and the teller inseparable. When this connection happens, the teller becomes an agent not of performance, but of authenticity. And the authentic teller builds a special relationship with listeners. And then the story becomes real. Jackie Ford, you created this special relationship with us. Thank you for demonstrating through your honesty and humor why personal stories are often viewed as the consummate avenue for delivering magic in its most truthful form. Stay put, because Brian and Jason are up next with To Tell the World. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, hope you join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and we want you to treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you, because our So What's Your Story team will forever be reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Theater Under the Stars presents the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home, running May 16th through May 28th at the Hobby Center for the Performing Arts. Based on Alison Bechdel's best-selling graphic memoir, Fun Home is the winner of 5 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. Fun Home is an honest musical that takes a look at one's parents through grown-up eyes. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit Tuts.com. This is KPFT Houston.
Gather around, KPFT listeners from all over the greater Houston area. We're inviting you to a unique show of epic proportions.
Join us for the second Saturday KPFT fundraiser, where KPFT's own Free Minstrel Show and Friends present a spectacular spectacle at Station Theater, Houston's home for long-form improvised comedy.
We'll see you there on May 13th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Station Theater is located at 1230 Houston Avenue. Parking is free down Dart Street and at the Tire Shop.
Visit stationtheater.com/KPFT for more details. You're listening to KPFT Houston.